when Detective Neil Bullard called a little while ago. She and Neil go back a long way. She adores him, but she's never happy to hear from him. "Missing kid," he said tersely today in response to her greeting, and her heart sank. It's rarely good news when Neil calls. The best she can hope for is closure on one of the cases she helped with in the past, a suspect apprehended, or a body located. On a handful of occasions, a missing person Lucinda sought will actually be found alive, usually a teenaged runaway, but once an Alzheimer's patient who wandered away from a nursing care facility. But usually, when Neil calls, someone new has gone missing in the greater metropolitan area. And kids are the worst. "How long has this one been gone?" she asked Neil.
"Less than 24.
"Parents?"
"Ruled out. I told them about you. They want you there. Can you come?"
"Don't I always?" She was already hunting for her car keys.
"Yeah," Neil said gruffly. "Always. So get your butt over here, and be discreet."
He always reminds her of that, as if it's necessary after all these years, as if he expects her to stick a screaming light dome on top of her car and a sign on the door that reads, "Lucinda Sloan, Psychic Investigator." Wouldn't she love to do just that someday and park in the driveway of the Sloan Mansion?
Yeah,
that would go over big with the mainline crowd. Finding the envelope on the seat, she checks the address he gave her against the house number she's passing. They're descending. Yeah, she's going in the right direction. Another intersection. Then one more. She's getting closer. This is the block. She'd know even if it wasn't for the addresses. Not because she's psychic, or because there are news satellite trucks swarming. Yet. She has no doubt that they'll be here. For the moment, though, there are only telltale clusters of somber-faced neighbors on porches and lawns. They look up warily as the unfamiliar car passes. Lucinda can feel their eyes on her and wonders if they're dutifully noting her license plate, just in case a skinny, auburn-haired female stranger turns out to be the suspect behind all this. Lucinda slows the car, crawling along so that she can check the numbers on her right. 60, 54, 48. There. That should be it. An unremarkable house, white with black shutters, just like Neil said. There's a squad car in the driveway and another at the curb. An unfamiliar uniformed officer is behind the wheel of that one, and he turns to watch Lucinda park behind him. Neil is somewhere in the house. She can see his sedan parked up the block. She takes her time getting out of her car, taking in every possible detail. There are two windows on either side of the front door, three more windows on the second floor, gray shingled A-line roof, brick chimney, concrete steps, wrought iron railings, low boxwood hedges, an American flag. Someone's working class dream home, now the scene of every parent's worst nightmare. To the right of the front door, beneath the brass lantern-style fixture, is the house number. 42. It's about time. Cam has finally made it to the head of the world's longest supermarket line ever, and none too soon. She's read enough of the National Enquirer to know that, supposedly, Nicole is secretly pregnant. Jennifer is plotting a breakup, and everyone's favorite married action hero has a secret boyfriend.
Ha! They think they've got troubles.
"Do you have any coupons?" The cashier, wearing a name tag that reads Karen, trainee, which explains a lot, scans Cam's first item. "No, no coupons." She did clip a few, but they're at home with her grocery list. Without that, she went through the store filling her cart with everything they could possibly need. And a few things we almost certainly won't, she thinks, watching Karen, trainee, ring up a can of Pringles. Cam bought that on a whim. Just in case.
along with a six-pack of Dr. Pepper, and a marble notebook. She spotted that in the office supplies aisle, which she usually doesn't bother to peruse unless Tess needs poster board for a school project or something. Today, Cam found herself wheeling her cart up the aisle, stopping in front of the notebooks, putting one into her cart. "Does that mean you're starting the whole thing over again? The painstaking notes on your visions, the constant searching for would-be victims, the endless sense of powerlessness? What choice does she have? If the visions are going to come again, she's going to log them. And maybe now that she's older and wiser, with keen maternal empathy, she'll be able to actually do something about what she sees." The conveyor belt inches agonizingly forward, and Cam unloads a few more items from the cart onto the end, thinking that if Karen, trainee, doesn't pick up the pace a little, she won't have time to visit the library for beach books. Plus, she still has to stop at the... Her ringing cell phone interrupts her thoughts. Flipping it open, she adds something else to the mental to-do list. She'd better charge her phone as soon as she gets home. According to the screen, she's down to one bar of battery power. She doesn't recognize the number on the caller ID. It's local, though, and she picks it up.
Mom?
Hi, Tess. What's...
Can you come get me?
Now? She checks her watch, wondering if she lost track of time. But it's only 2:30. Is the party over already?
No.
Tess sounds miserable, like she's been crying. Her heart sinks. What happened?
I just need you to come, please.
You're scaring me. Are you all right?
Not really.
Please, dear God. Are you hurt? A pause. Tess, are you hurt? Cam's heart and thoughts race wildly, and she prepares to abandon her groceries and run.
No, I just have to get out of here.
Okay, so it's not an emergency, as far as she can tell. Not a life and death one, anyway. What's going on there? Are the kids doing something you don't feel comfortable with? In a flash, Cam remembers her own high school party days. Sex, drugs, rock and roll. Terrific.
I just want to leave. Right now, I'm going to start walking up Highland.
In the rain?
It's not raining that hard.
Tess, it's that bad that you can't stay there and wait for me? Cam asks helplessly, watching the cashier take her sweet old time putting an orange paid sticker on a 12-pack of paper towels.
It's that bad,
Tess confirms, sniffling. Listen, I'm about 10 minutes away, Cam tells her. Just wait there and...
I'll be walking. Bye, Mom.
Tess! She's already hung up. Chapter 6. This is it. Ken Roby holds the door open for Lucinda, who crosses the threshold to the plush lavender carpet of a young girl's bedroom. A police officer stands sentry in the doorway. Lucinda's heart aches for Leah's blonde, bespectacled father, whose hand is visibly shaking as he reaches for the roller shade to raise it. He's clean-cut, young, maybe a little older than Lucinda is, probably in his mid to late 30s. The shade goes up, and gray light falls through the window, framed in white eyelet curtains that match the bed skirt. "Do you want me to turn on the light?" Ken asks. The room is dim, even with the shade raised all the way. Her instinct is to say yes. She's never liked the dark, not since she was a little girl, afraid of the boogeyman and convinced bad things happen only under cover of darkness. Yeah, she knows better now. But the first thing she does when entering any room, even in the daytime, is flip a light switch. Unless she's doing an investigation. No, thanks, Lucinda tells Ken Roby. She doesn't necessarily need to see every last detail of his daughter's bedroom. It's just as important, if not more so, that she use her other senses, especially the so-called sixth. She walks slowly to the center of the room, where 13-year-old Leah woke up yesterday morning. Shortly after, She left for St. Hedwig's school on the other side of town and never came home. No one in her family has seen Leah Roby since. Stopping beside the twin bed, Lucinda gazes at the rainbow quilt with matching throw pillows, the lovingly propped stuffed unicorn. She has a thing for rainbows and unicorns, huh? Lucinda comments, gesturing at the bed, the framed prints on the walls, the figurines that line a bookshelf. It's all Lisa Frank stuff. Leah loves it. Most of her friends have outgrown it, but she still spends all her allowance on it. Lucinda nods. How many girls' rooms has she visited, decorated in their current obsession? Barbie, Polly Pocket, Strawberry Shortcake. And how many heart-wrenching funerals has she attended where a doll or a favorite stuffed animal is tucked into the open casket? She expertly shuts out the disturbing reality of her work and focuses on the business at hand, turning back to the bed. A pair of violet-sprigged pajamas are draped over the headboard's post. "She wore these Wednesday night?" she asks Ken Roby, who nods bleakly and turns away to brush away tears. His wife, Rebecca, couldn't even bring herself to come upstairs. Red-eyed and depleted, she's huddled on the couch, holding an untouched glass of water some well-meaning relative or neighbor put into her hand. Lucinda has seen it all before, too many times. The shattered mother, voice raw from screaming, the devastated father trying to stay strong, the support system of family and friends there to answer the phone, bring in food nobody eats, and keep the other kids in the family occupied. Police officers with squawking radios keeping a watchful eye on the bystanders and press who invariably show up outside. Detectives, Neil included, asking questions and taking notes. And then there's Lucinda Sloan, who has walked onto scenes like this one too many times to count, but not too many times to be profoundly affected by the familiar unfolding drama. She's a pro, though, after spending the better part of a decade on this work, and though she left her blue blood roots behind years ago, that impeccable mainline breeding rendered her an expert at keeping up the facade, masking sloppy emotions. So she doesn't fall apart, ever, in front of the missing child's loved ones, or anyone else for that matter, not even when she realizes that the child is never coming home again. Sometimes that knowledge is instantaneous. Occasionally the terrible truth strikes her even before she arrives on the scene. That didn't happen with Leah Roby. She still doesn't know whether the girl is alive or dead, but she probably isn't a runaway. No, Lucinda's gut instinct is that sometime yesterday afternoon, Leah crossed paths with someone who stole her from her family and has no intention of letting her go. They never do. Driving toward Highland Avenue with her car full of groceries, Cam curses the rain, the other drivers in her way, and especially the inept cashier who made a mistake that required a thorough perusal of the register tape, followed by the manager's time-consuming attention. Yes, and instead of hollering, "Manager," she simply flipped a switch so that her lane number flashed overhead. Then she waited. And waited. Finally, Cam yelled, "Manager," which didn't go over very well with Karen, trainee, or with Trishonda, manager. Too bad. Cam has to get to her daughter. Tess is in trouble. She keeps telling herself that it's probably just a typical teenaged crisis, a falling out with her friends, or maybe she unexpectedly got her period, which she has yet to start. Still, Cam's sense of urgency has grown stronger by the minute. By the time she actually reaches the Highland intersection, she's all but frantic, and of course, the light is yellow. She speeds toward it, but it's already turning red. "Damn, damn, damn!" She slams on the brakes and exhales shakily. "Okay, calm down. This stress isn't good for the baby. You're making a big deal out of nothing." Whoa. A familiar dizziness spins in, and she clutches the wheel, the image of a gory wound flashing through her mind. Just a fleeting glimpse, bright red blood, torn, fair flesh. Cam winces and shakes her head to rid it of the image. Then another replaces it, again. Just a blink, and then gone. Tess's face, contorted in pain. Tess hurt, bleeding. Cam's daughter is in danger. She knows it, beyond a shadow of a doubt. She can feel it more profoundly than she's ever felt another person's pain in her premonitions, because this time, the child is her own. And I have to get to her before it happens, because it will. The things she sees always, always come to pass. Clenching her jaw, Cam lifts her foot from the brake, checks for oncoming traffic, and goes through the red light, tires squealing as she rounds the corner. "Do you mind if," Lucinda asks Leah's father as she reaches for the girl's pajamas, her latex-gloved hand poised for permission. He turns. "Oh, no. Go ahead. Touch whatever you have to." Lucinda picks up the pajamas, holds them, wraps the soft fabric around her forearms, closing her eyes. "Come on, Leah. Where are you?" The detectives on the case are pretty sure she got off the school bus yesterday afternoon at a different stop, about a half mile before her own. A few kids and the driver thought they remembered seeing her get off there, though no one thought anything of it. Kids take the bus to different stops all the time, for playdates with friends. But it turns out that shy Leah doesn't have many friends, and none who live off Loon Road. So why did she get off the bus there? No one knows. She sat alone, as usual, and didn't talk to anyone. At the Loon Road stop, the other kids quickly scattered. It was a nice day, and they were eager to get home. Leah Roby never did. Lucinda opens her eyes and wanders over to Leah's desk as her father stands at the window, staring out. "We were always so careful with her." He sounds as if he's talking to himself, but Lucinda listens closely. "When she learned to walk, I can't tell you how much duct tape I went through." Duct tape. In her mind's eye, Lucinda sees a silvery gray roll of duct tape in gloved hands. The ominous vision is there, then gone, leaving her with a familiar sick feeling in her gut. "I used to wrap folded towels around the edges of all the tables in the house and tape them," Leah's father says, "kind of like bumpers, so she wouldn't fall against a hard corner." Lucinda nods, but Ken isn't even looking at her. "And when we found out she was allergic to peanuts," he goes on, "my wife got her out of school every single day for lunch so that she wouldn't accidentally come into contact with some other kid's PB&J sandwich. We never took a chance with her. Ever. And now..." He trails off, swallows hard, and continues to gaze at the dreary world beyond his daughter's bedroom window. Lucinda turns back to the desk. On it is an assortment of adolescent girl possessions, books, a ballerina music box, a bin filled with colorful, sparkly art supplies, and rainbow and unicorn stickers. There are a couple of framed photos, Leah with her parents and younger brothers, with a friend, by herself, dressed up and holding a flute. Lifting that one, Lucinda stares long and hard at Leah, memorizing her features. Blonde wispy hair, light hazel eyes, blonde lashes. She looks like her dad. All at once, an image barges into Lucinda's mind. The sea. She takes a deep breath, expecting to smell salt air and sunscreen. Sometimes that happens. Not today. Today, she can only see the water, can't smell it or hear crashing waves. Then something rises from the green-black depths in the distance, out beyond the breakers. A fin. A shark? "What is it?" Ken Roby's voice distracts her, and she opens her eyes to see him watching her worriedly. Are you having some kind of vision? Lucinda hesitates. I saw the ocean. Does that mean anything to you? He shakes his head slowly, fearfully. Do you think she's in the water? I'm not sure. That's not what I saw, though. She won't tell him about the fin. Fins are inherently ominous, and anyway, she's not sure whether to take it literally or symbolically. She's learned after years of interpreting what she sees that it works both ways. All she can do is try to work with what she gets. She closes her eyes again and concentrates, hoping the vision will return. A few minutes pass. Nothing. Is there anything here that Leah wore a lot? She asks Ken, glancing around the room. Or something she used every day, maybe? He thinks for a moment, then shrugs. How about her school uniform? She wears one every day, a skirt and vest. She has a few. You can see them if you want to. He walks toward the closet. The only other thing I can think of that would fit the bill is her backpack, but she had that with her yesterday. It was her favorite color. Purple. Lucinda follows him, then notices something on the dresser top as they pass. A white, jewelry-sized cardboard gift box. Seeing it, she feels inexplicably uneasy. Do you know what that's from? She asks Ken, walking over to it. I have no idea. The box is open, sitting inside its top, where nothing more than a rectangle of white cotton is visible. Did she get a present recently? Lucinda asks, turning to Ken. For a birthday or... Her birthday's not until August. She'll be 14. She can read his mind. Anyone would be able to do that, though. The ravaged look on his face makes it plain that Leah's father is asking God to please let his daughter turn 14 in August. Please let her survive, wherever she is. Lucinda picks up the box. She can tell it's empty even before she lifts the cotton pad to see if anything slipped beneath. Nothing. Nothing, that is, Lucinda realizes, her heart beating faster. But a few grains of what looks like sand. At last the rain has passed. The new copper fire pit is finally blazing in the nearby clearing. These days, everyone has one. Families gather cozily around them at night, toasting marshmallows in their own backyards. It isn't night, and there's no family here. Not officially. Still, if anyone in the vicinity was to randomly happen into the far reaches of the property, and they won't, but even if they did, the fire pit wouldn't necessarily give anything away. No. Because I've thought of everything. What looks like a simple poker is propped with the handle end against the copper rim, the other end buried in burning embers. A bag of marshmallows sits at the ready on a makeshift log bench beside the pit. The latter is propped against a cherry tree nearby in the wooded section, once an orchard. The fruit isn't in season yet, but for all anyone knows, the latter's been there since last summer. Today's earlier rain now equals mud. Ugly. Filthy. Weighs a ton. It's taken 15 minutes to dig through it to the trap door, and it's going to take more than just a heating pad and a good night's sleep to ease the resulting back pain. Maybe I should have waited a day or two for this part. After all, it's not like she's going anyplace, or likely to be dying of starvation down there. It's been less than 24 hours, and she has bread and water. Huh. Just like prison. Which is fitting, because that's pretty much where she is, and where she'll stay from now on. And it's your own fault, little girl. If she were an obedient child and could be trusted not to run away, she could sleep indoors in a nice clean bed, the way she used to. Almost there.
One more shovelful should give access to the door. Or break my back. One or the other. That would be her fault, too. Just like these blisters on my hands from all that digging yesterday. These gloves are going to be bloody inside by the time I get finished today. Her fault. All her fault. And I won't let her ever forget it. She'll pay for everything she's done to make my life a living hell. You made this happen, you know. You're responsible for your own actions. So don't you dare start crying to me when I open this door. No response. Yeah, well, she probably can't hear a thing from down there. Just as well. That means no one can hear her if she screams. These nice thick gloves are coming in handy today in every way. The old iron ring handle is cold and caked in mud. I don't feel like getting my poor blistered hands filthy on top of everything else. What if I got an infection and had to see a doctor? That wouldn't be good. No, but it wouldn't necessarily be a giveaway. It's not as if the doctor would take one look at a bunch of blisters and connect them to the supposedly kidnapped child miles away in a Philly suburb. Kidnapped? That's rich. I'm just claiming what's rightfully mine. Mine. Soaked hair and smeared makeup are the last thing on Tess's mind as she walks up Highland Avenue in the rain. Like Julius Caesar, she was betrayed. Et tu, Morrow? How could she have done this to me? Morrow is one of her best friends. Tess trusted her, helped her pass the English final. Yeah, and if I had just let her fail, this never would have happened. Tess will never live this down. The only saving grace is that school is over and she's leaving town tomorrow. Thank God it'll be a few months before she has to face any of them. Morrow, Chad, Lily, most of all, Heath. Heath, who not only now knows that Tess is alive, but has seen the black and white evidence of her private daydreams about him. Tess Hastings Pickering. Tess Ava Hastings Pickering. Tess Pickering. You idiot. How could she have forgotten that she had written all that in her notebook before she lent it to Morrow? How could Morrow have not only shown it to Chad, but let Chad show it to Heath? You told me to tell Chad you liked Heath, Morrow protested to Tess, all innocent. I mean, I thought it was just so cute that you were practicing writing your married name. So did Chad. Just so cute? It was just so ridiculous, that's what it was. If only Morrow and Chad hadn't shown up at the party after all. Tess shudders, remembering how she ran right over to them the moment they arrived. Chad promptly announced, "Hey, look, it's Mrs. Heath Pickering." Morrow immediately swatted his arm and hissed, "You promised not to do that." Of course, Jordan Runyon and her friends just happened to be in earshot. And of course, Chad had to tell them all about the page Morrow had found in Tess's English notebook. They were all laughing when she bolted into the house. At least Morrow had the decency to come running after her, trailed by Lily, who had also heard about it, but was less amused than the others. "That was a shitty thing to do," Lily told Morrow in the mirrored first-floor changing room as Tess collapsed into a chair and buried her face in her hands. "She wanted me to find out if Heath likes her." "That's not what she meant, and you knew it," Lily told her. "Please don't tell me Chad told Heath," Tess begged, not daring to look at Morrow's face. "Heath was flattered," was the reply. "Who wouldn't be?" Lily moaned. Tess cried. Spotting herself in the mirror, she saw that the waterproof mascara isn't waterproof at all. Ribbons of black were streaming down her cheeks. She realized this was going to go around school faster than a stomach bug. Around school? Around the world, thanks to MySpace and Facebook.
"Listen, when Heath shows up, he was supposed to be here already, so I have no idea where he is. I promise, I'll introduce..." Morrow began, but Tess cut her off. "No, no way." "But forget it," Tess said.
I don't ever want to see him again. You either. Mauro protested, spewing apologies, and Lily tried to play peacemaker. But Tess kicked them both out of the room. She called her mother and snuck out of the house without saying goodbye. She's walked 3 long blocks already, barefoot, her beautiful, expensive new flip-flops left out by the pool. How is she going to get them back? You aren't. She's not going back to Lily's, ever. In fact, she's never going back to school, either. In the fall, she'll transfer to a private... Ow! A sharp pain jabs into the sole of her foot. Balancing on her left leg, Tess twists the other to see a shard of green glass sticking out of her right arch. Wincing, she pulls it out and examines the wound, where a bright red trickle of blood runs from the gash. For a split second, waking up in the dark, Leah thinks she's in her own bed, in her beautiful purple rainbow and unicorn bedroom. But that dark is different. Cozy. Safe. Familiar. This dark is clammy, filthy, terrifying. The air stinks terribly, and the ground is alive with invisible creatures that scurry and slither over Leah's bare hands and feet. She isn't in her own bed. She isn't home. She knows in her heart that she'll never be home again. Reality hits hard. So hard that Leah begs God to take her to heaven right now. Her teacher, Sister Mary Luke, said no one should ever be afraid to die because heaven is paradise, safe and filled with lost loved ones. Even so, Leah has always secretly been afraid. Afraid to leave her parents and her friends and her house and her life. That's already happened to you. Yes, and the thought of what might happen next, in this life, is far scarier than heaven as described by the elderly nun. Please, God, please help me. Please don't let this crazy person hurt me. Please don't. Overhead, a dull thud. Leah knows what that means. She won't be alone for long.
Please, God.
Why didn't she show someone the letter when it came? Mom or Dad, or even Sister Mary Luke, someone. Why didn't she show someone? But the letter said it had to be a secret, or she would be disqualified. Leah figured that was how those reality shows worked. They probably didn't want word getting out, because then everyone would want to be a contestant. Leah kept thinking of how nice it would be to surprise her parents by turning on the television one night and saying, "Hey, look who's on TV. It's me." And it would have been even better to surprise them with her winnings from the show. They were always worried about money. Their faces would light up if Leah won a treasure. Yes, and the girls at school, the ones who weren't very nice to Leah, would be jealous if she was on television. That was what she kept thinking. Maybe that's why this is happening to her. Because she had sinful thoughts, and she was greedy. She wanted the treasure, and stardom, and the cool shark's tooth necklace, too. Above, the heavy door creaks open and lands with a soft thud on the spongy ground beside the hole. Dear God, please, please take me now. I don't want to see that awful face again. I don't want to hear that horrible voice calling me by the wrong name, talking about Christmas presents, telling me I've been a bad girl. All her life, Leah has been a good girl. Surely she's going straight to heaven when she dies. And someday, Mommy and Daddy will meet her there. That's what Sister Mary Luke said. Please let it be quick when it happens, God. Please don't let me suffer. Please.
Tess, Cam calls through the open car window, rain washing over her along with relief. Up ahead on the sidewalk, her daughter turns. Her light brown hair is drenched, hanging in sopping strands that are plastered to her jaw and neck. Even from this distance, Cam can see the smudged black makeup running over her cheekbones and the look of anguish in her eyes.
Oh my God, what happened, sweetheart? She pulls up alongside Tess, who limps over, barefoot, as Cam throws her door open. The scenarios running through her head in the few seconds it takes Tess to answer are horrific. Did someone spike her drink with drugs? Attack her? Rape her?
Morrow, she destroyed me. I swear, Mom, I will never be friends with her again, ever.
She hurt you? Holding her daughter close, Cam tries to imagine Morrow, whom she personally considers a little snotty, but certainly not physically threatening, beating up Tess. She can't do it. Still, that's why you're limping? What did she do to you? The story that pours out of Tess is so reassuringly benign, compared to what she feared anyway, that it's all Cam can do to summon a sympathetic expression. I'm so sorry, sweetheart, she says gently, helping Tess into the front seat. Yes, when you're 14, being humiliated in front of your peers, and worse yet, your current crush, is devastating. And yes, teenaged internet networking exacerbates the situation, according to a melodramatic declaration from Tess, who is convinced she's about to become a global laughingstock. But thank God it's nothing worse. Adolescent broken hearts heal, and so do minor flesh wounds. Embarrassment subsides. Teen tormentors move on to a new scapegoat. It could have been so much worse. No one knows that better than Cam. Not a hint of artificial light from below. What's wrong? Flashlight burnout?
Yes,
comes the hollow, hoarse reply. That's a shame. It was new, too. And I'm fresh out of D batteries. I'll tell you what. Behave and I'll leave you this other flashlight I have. A flick of the switch illuminates the small figure huddled down there in the corner. It takes a few tries to prop the light at just the right angle to light the hole.
Please let me out of here.
The girl's voice is a barely audible croak.
I want to go home.
You are home, and it's about time. Do you know how many months I've wasted looking for you? Wait there. I'll be right back. First, the ladder. It's a lightweight one that takes mere moments to drag over from the cherry tree and lower into the hole. Touch that, and I'll kill you. The command is met by a pathetic whimper. I mean it. Don't you dare try to climb out of there. I'm right here, even though you can't see me. A quick trip to the fire pit, where the proper tool is waiting, and then back to the trap door with it. Good, she listened. She's murmuring something. Chanting, maybe. Illuminated in the glow of the overhead flashlight beam, she's nowhere near the ladder, still cowering in the corner. She's a meek little thing these days, nowhere near the defiant little brat she once was. It's almost a disappointment to see that the fight has gone out of her. Or has it? It might just be an act. She can't be trusted. I learned that the hard way. Now stay put, just like that. Do you understand me? You move a muscle while I'm on this ladder, and you die. No reply. Just fervent murmuring that sounds like she's reciting poetry. Or is she praying? She can't be. She doesn't know how. Unless someone taught her. The thought is both infuriating and amusing. She's going to need all the help she can get, and it certainly isn't going to come from any earthly source at this point. Shut up. Do you hear me? Right now. Shut up if you know what's good for you. Not that you ever did. She does now. She falls silent. The ladder shakes on the descent, just as it did on all the practice runs. It wouldn't take much to knock it off balance. A kid, even a skinny little thing like her, could easily accomplish it, if she chose to. But wisely, she doesn't. She stays put like a good girl. Maybe she's changed. Or maybe she's just trying to fool me. The ladder wobbles crazily to one side. Whoa, close call. Below, there's a sudden gasp, a high-pitched cry.
What are you holding?
So she spotted it. There goes the element of surprise. Oh well. This is just something that will make sure you don't forget where you belong, just in case you are tempted to run away again. Now that I've found you, you're staying here with me. The girl is sobbing again.
Please, please don't hurt me.
Oh, come on. It won't be so bad. How much farther to go? Ah, one more rung, and then another, and, at last, contact with the solid cellar floor. The darkness is pungent, the musty smell of damp earth mingling with the stench of human excrement and vomit. It's impossible not to gag. Thank God this won't take long. This place reeks. How can you stand it? The question is met with another question, posed in a quavering, barely audible voice.
What are you doing with that?
We can do this in a nice, civilized fashion, and it'll be over before you know it. Come here and stand up.
No! Get away from me!
She tries to crawl away, but there's nowhere for her to go. Have it your way. But if you squirm all over the place and make me hold you down, this could get messy, and much more painful than it needs to be.
No!
The girl's protest is curtailed as she slammed down onto her back. Eyes wide in terror, she watches helplessly as the red-hot brand descends. A blood-curdling scream escapes her as the blazing iron encounters tender young skin. Shut up! The girl ignores the command, screeching as though she's in a torture chamber. Don't be ridiculous. It's already over. Stay still. Let me see. Stay still! Ah, there. Perfect. The brand left an indelible mark in the center of her forehead. Just one word. The only one that matters. There for all the world to see. Mine. Pulling into the driveway at home with her daughter safe and sound, though miserable, beside her, Cam can't help but think about last night's false alarm. First, she burst into Tess's room, fearing for her safety for no reason other than a gut instinct that she was in danger. Now this. It's getting ridiculous. She really has to stop jumping to conclusions. Can pregnancy hormones be responsible for exacerbating her paranoia? Sure they can, she reminds herself as she drives toward home. Bleeding gums, crying over stupid TV commercials, panicky food cravings. Dr. Advani blames a lot of crazy symptoms on pregnancy hormones. Cam leaves the car out in the driveway. She'll have to go back out later to finish the last few errands. Can you go ahead and open the door for me? She asks Tess, opening the back gate to start unloading groceries. Still sniffling, her daughter dutifully hobbles to the front door. Cam grabs a couple of bags and the six-pack of Dr. Pepper and follows, wishing she hadn't bought this stuff for Mike. Tess is going to notice and assume that...
Mom? I thought you set the alarm.
I did.
Why? You didn't. You must have forgotten.
Tess holds the door open for her. Oh, I guess I must have. Cam frowns as she steps over the threshold. She could swear she remembers setting the alarm, especially since she was still so jittery about her latest vision last night. Then again, Tess was rushing her out the door. And pregnancy hormones. They can cause forgetfulness, too. You left your grocery list and coupons at home. What makes you think you didn't forget about the alarm, too? Still, the nagging question lingers in Cam's mind. What if there's more to the disarmed alarm and her certainty that Tess was in danger than pregnancy hormones? Did someone break into the house while they were gone? She has the distinct feeling that someone was here, yet nothing seems out of place as she and Tess walk through the quiet rooms to the kitchen. What should I put on my foot? Tess sinks into a kitchen chair and examines her cut, adding almost accusingly, since Dad's not here to do it. First aid was Mike's department. Somehow he always happened to be around to tend to their daughter's bruises and bloodshed. I'll do it. We need to clean it. I'll get peroxide. Cam murmurs, and goes toward the half-bath to search the medicine cabinet. Tess stops her.
The stuff's in the utility closet in a plastic shoebox, second shelf from the top.
Oh, right. Tess sniffles miserably. Come on, Cam. Forget about the alarm. Forget about everything but Tess, at least for now. You're her mom. You can do this just as well as Mike. Better, even.
Peroxide and cotton balls in hand, along with antibiotic ointment, bandages, and an empty blue rubber ice pack, she stops at the fridge on the way back.
What are you doing? Tess wants to know.
Getting ice. She opens the freezer.
Do cuts need ice?
Sure they do.
Don't they?
Who knows? Feeling helpless, hopeless, and as irritated with Mike for making himself resident caregiver as she is with herself for letting him, Cam scoops cubes into the open neck of the ice pack. She slams the door, and of course, the magnetic shopping pad drops off the front of the fridge. Well, Tess does think you're the world's best mom, she reminds herself, seeing the slogan across the top page as she bends to pick up the pad. Then, wait a minute. The page is blank. Where's her shopping list? Earlier, she checked her pockets, her purse, and the car before realizing she didn't have it with her. Meaning it should be here where she left it, right?
Right.
So where is it? And why isn't the alarm set?
And what is wrong with me? Am I losing my mind?
Mom, this really hurts.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm coming.
Cam kneels beside her daughter.
Here, let me see.
Ow, be careful.
I'm being careful.
When was your last tetanus shot?
You're asking me?
No, I'm asking me, and I can't remember. I should call the doctor. This might sting, she warns, soaking a cotton ball with peroxide as her mind reels.
What if her vision about Tess, bloody and in trouble, was about more than a friend's betrayal and stepping on a piece of glass? The whole nightmare situation with Morrow and the notebook and the bloody foot could have been a mere coincidence. As the peroxide penetrates the wound, Tess cries out in pain. Cam's blood runs cold at the sound.
It'll be okay, sweetie, she says soothingly, struggling to push aside irrational fear as she strokes the ointment over her daughter's wound.
It's just a cut. It'll heal fast.
But what if, please God, no,
the real drama involving Tess still lies ahead.
Here, I brought you something.
Lying on the dirt floor, the child doesn't move a muscle. Even a swift kick doesn't rouse her. She might as well be a pile of rags.
Why did I even bother?
The answer is humbling.
Because I don't want it to be like this, captor and captive. This isn't how it was supposed to be. It wouldn't have come to this, though, if she hadn't left in the first place. And again, when I found her. And again, the next time. Over and over again. She always leaves. This is the only way.
Clearly, this is the only way it can be. Captor and captive, branded like an animal for all to see so there can be no mistake.
You know, I could have just left you here to wallow in misery, but I didn't.
No, I went all the way up to the house to get you an ice pack for your forehead. And candy, too.
Don't you want some?
Candy. It always was the magic word. The girl turns her head at last.
Ah, the earlier handiwork is most effective. Beneath the etched, raw, but clearly legible mark on her forehead, her eyes are wary.
Here, see?
It's your favorite.
The girl's gaze settles on the proffered peace offering. Reese's peanut butter cups. But she doesn't light up and sees the candy the way she used to.
Well, she's still shaken up, poor thing.
Poor thing. She'll get over it.
Don't go feeling guilty. Don't forget for one second she brought this on herself.
Do you know what? First we'll do your hair.
Then you can have your treat. Deal?
No response.
Look at these tangles. I'm afraid this isn't going to be easy.
The brush gets snagged a quarter of the way down the first strands. That gets a response.
Ouch!
Sit still. You haven't been brushing 100 strokes a night like I taught you, have you? The brush is stuck again. This time it takes a few hard tugs to get it loose.
Ow!
Sorry. Her hair seems silkier, more easily tangled. Maybe the blonde dye has changed the texture. There. How's that? One nice braid down your back, and now you can have your treat. The girl turns away.
I don't want it.
Go ahead. Take it. The gentle tone is fraying fast.
I can't.
What do you mean you can't? I got it just for you. Now take it. Her lip trembles.
Stop yelling at me.
I suppose you want those gingerbread cookies I promised you, don't you?
What are you talking about?
You'll get them later. It was going to be a surprise. I baked them just for you. No surprise, no gratitude, no reaction other than apparent bewilderment. Look, just take the damn candy. I don't have all day.
I can't. I'm allergic.
What?
Peanut butter. I can't eat it. I'm allergic.
Don't be ridiculous. You're not allergic to anything.
I break out in hives.
You've never broken out in hives in your life. Stop lying. Here. A quick crinkling of the wrapper, and the candy is open, thrust toward the girl's mouth. Eat it.
I can't.
Eat it. The child's jaws are forced open, the candy jammed into her mouth. She writhes, gagging, choking. Drooling saliva streaked with chocolate. As she raises her hand toward her mouth, desperate to get the candy out, the overhead flashlight beam catches something metallic at her wrist. A bracelet. A bracelet with a flat ID tag on it.
Let me see that.
Ow! You're twisting my arm!
A fierce tug and the bracelet snaps off. There. The light is dim down here, but if it's tilted at just the right angle, the engraved letters become visible. Leah Roby. The name means nothing. Of course it wouldn't. She's always used fake names. She's dyed, cut, and grown her hair, has even worn colored contacts. As if she can fool me. As if I wouldn't know her anywhere, even with a disguise. Beneath the fake name is a fake birth date and fake contact information, along with a medical alert that Leah Roby has a severe nut allergy. Yeah, right. Still, she's putting on a good act, going limp, gasping as though she's having a hard time breathing.
In my backpack, the child moans. An EpiPen, please.
Stop the melodrama.
Please.
The thing is, there's something on the girl's face that wasn't there a few minutes ago. Some kind of rash that looks like a couple of harsh red bumps. Hives.
Please.
The girl, the wrong girl, begs as her throat swells closed.
Please, help me.
The truth hits like a killing frost. In its wake, hope. Foolish, naive hope withers and dies. The wrong girl, an imposter.
Please help, Epi.
You know, I'm really sorry about this. Leah? Is that your name? I thought you were someone else. My bad. This means she's still out there somewhere. But where? It's like looking for a needle in a haystack, or a shark's tooth on a beach. The beach, the one where it all began. And it's time to go back.
Amazing. It's really happening, just like Leah prayed.
Oddly, it hasn't really even hurt much, other than the hairbrush. It was scary at first, though. Dying. Really scary. Not anymore. Lying on the floor, no longer struggling to breathe, no longer fighting to survive, Leah thinks of her parents as she waits for the angels and the white light. Sister Mary Luke said that's how it would be. Angels and white light. Mom and Dad are going to be so sad. That's the worst part. They're going to be crying a lot when they find out. More even than they did at Grandma's funeral. Funeral. What will hers be like? Will they put her in the beautiful pink dress Mom got her for Easter? She only got to wear it once. Maybe she'll be able to watch her funeral from wherever she is, in heaven, with Grandma and God. God, who heard Leah's prayer and rescued her from the devil itself, a devil with an angry, accusing voice and eyes that flicker with madness, seeing someone else when they look right at Leah. Some other girl. A girl who likes chocolate peanut butter cups and gingerbread. Wherever she is, I hope the devil never finds her, is Leah Roby's last thought. Tess's cell phone buzzes late that night. Someone is sending her a text message. She reaches for it in the dark, certain it's going to be Morrow with an apology. The sender's number is unfamiliar. Hi, Tess. This is Heath. Her stomach lurches. Chad. It has to be. Thinking it would be a hilarious prank to text her posing as Heath. For all she knows, a bunch of his friends, yeah, and Morrow and Lily and God knows who else, are all there with him. Shaking, Tess types in a response. Leave me alone. She looks at it for a minute. Then she scrolls back to edit her message. Leave me the hell alone. There. Better. She hits send. Then she holds down the end button until the power shuts down and tosses the phone across the room. It hits the wall hard and drops to the floor in at least two pieces. Who cares? Who needs a phone? Tess thinks, hot tears soaking her pillow. When you have no friends. Downstairs at the kitchen table, Cam turns to the third page in the marble notebook, then hesitates, pen in hand. The first two pages are lined with her handwriting. One is dated May, followed by as much information as she can recall about the vision she had that night in her kitchen, about the little blonde girl in the cellar. It's surprising how many details she remembered. Maybe it's because it was the first vision after so many years and caught her off guard. Or maybe because her brain is no longer affected by alcohol, whose very purpose was to cloud the visions. Whatever the case, she wrote down everything from what the girl was wearing to the purple backpack to the house with the number 42. Most striking of all was the silver necklace with the triangular black pendant. She underlined it several times, circled it, knowing it has some kind of meaning. Because she saw it twice, on two different girls. The second page, with yesterday's date, covers the vision of the sunburnt, red-headed girl in front of the blue wall that looks so familiar. She already scribbled her notes on that vision, but she's looked everywhere and has no idea what she did with the shopping list. That's been eating away at her all night, along with the alarm she thought she'd set and hadn't. But she has other things to worry about. On page two, Cam wrote down every image she glimpsed last night, from the red bubble letters LF to the pink toenail polish to, again, the black pendant on a silver chain. Again, underlined several times. What the hell does it mean? Reluctantly, she puts today's date at the top of the third page. Then, pen wavering above the paper, she shakes her head. Go on. What did you see today in the car? Tess. Tess's skin. Tess's blood. Okay, she didn't actually see her, and it wasn't a full-blown vision. Just an overwhelming sense that her daughter was going to be in trouble. And injured. And she was. Her friends betrayed her. She sliced open her foot, had to go to the doctor and get a painful tetanus shot, which made Tess squeeze Cam's hand so hard it still feels bruised. So, the brief premonition has already come to pass. Why bother writing it down? Because what if that wasn't... No, Cam tells herself sharply. It was. It's over. That was it. That was all. She tears out the empty dated page, snaps the cap back on the pen, and closes the notebook. After crumpling and tossing the paper, she turns off the kitchen lights and goes over to the pile of luggage by the back door. There she hesitates again. Are you sure you need this? Any of it? No, she's not sure of anything. She unzips the tote bag, slips the notebook in on top of the others, zips the bag closed again. Then she climbs the stairs in the dark, silent house. At Tess's door, she pauses. Then she cracks it open, peeks inside, sees the huddled form in the bed. Good. She's asleep. Poor kid. Cam closes the door and goes down the hall to her own empty bed. Part 3, July, Chapter 7.
Does it get any better than this? Debbie Merriman sighs contentedly. I mean, look around.
Sitting beside Debbie in a low canvas chair, bare toes buried in warm sand, Cam glances up from the open book on her lap. Following her friend's gaze, she looks out over the crowded strand. The island's summer residents, weekenders, day trippers, and locals are out in force. Some well-oiled and sprawled in the glaring sun, others well-screened and chilling beneath bright-colored umbrellas. Frisbees soar, elaborate sandcastles rise, lifeguards keep a watchful eye on waders, swimmers, and boogie boards in the bracing surf. Out beyond the ridge of foaming white breakers, buzzing jet skis cut across the darker blue water of the Atlantic, shimmering in the golden midday sun. Nope, Cam agrees, trying not to sound forced. It definitely doesn't get any better than this. She's known Debbie for about a week. That's plenty long enough to realize that she's the last person who wants to hear that Mike's conspicuous absence from Cam's life makes everything, even this glorious seaside day, decidedly imperfect. The first time Cam mentioned that she misses her husband, Debbie's expression soured instantly. You're better off on your own, trust me. You're capable of taking care of yourself and your daughter. You don't need him. Maybe she does, but she wouldn't admit it to Debbie, who is recently and bitterly divorced. So bitterly, for that matter, that not only does Debbie never have a kind word for her ex-husband, but she's pretty much peeved at men in general. All men, including total strangers, like Mike. There is one thing I can think of that would be better than this, Debbie says. Yeah? What's that? Cam is positive she's not going to mention Greg, her ex, back in Phoenix. Debbie doesn't miss him. Far from it. She's moved her kids, Beth, 14, and 10-year-old Jonathan, across the country to get away from him. A flight attendant, she transferred her base back east to Newark Airport and moved back to her hometown in Monmouth County, where her parents still live. Cam senses there's more to Debbie's story than she's heard so far, and that the sordid details will come out before the summer's over. She's not in any hurry to hear them, or to share her own in return. If we were on a lush Caribbean island being waited on hand and foot by attentive cabana boys, right? Cam grins. That does sound pretty good. Doesn't it? I can get you a flight dirt cheap, maybe even free. How about a girls-only weekend down there in the fall? By fall, Cam herself will be the size of a small Caribbean island. That's hurricane season, she reminds Debbie. So, what are the odds of getting hit? Hey, do you see the girls? Debbie cups a hand over her brows and scans the beach for Beth and Tess. Down by the lifeguard stand, Cam promptly points in that direction, where her daughter, looking particularly angular and childlike beside Debbie's daughter,
who even from here looks like a Brazilian Miss Universe contestant. "And in case you were wondering," she adds, sensing Debbie's searching gaze, "Jonathan's still over there." Cam arcs her arm over toward the lapping waterline, helping those little kids with their sandcastle. "Oh, right, I see him. Wow, Cam, you're good." She is good. Unable to shake those visions she was having back home about Tess, she hasn't let her daughter out of her sight for more than a few minutes since they arrived in Beach Haven. It wasn't all that challenging to keep an eye on Tess in the beginning. The sky opened up the moment they crossed the causeway onto the island at ship bottom the first day here, and it was no fluke. The remainder of June was unseasonably cool and rainy, forcing Cam and Tess to spend the first 2 weeks here as an inseparable twosome. Cooped up in the cottage, they played endless board games, read stacks of books and magazines, even watched rented movies, something Mike never allowed at the beach, to Tess's perpetual dismay. Cam had intended to stick with Mike's no TV on vacation rule, but after a few days of rain, she relented. After all, who's in charge here? The gray shingled cottage on Dolphin Avenue, like the big colonial in Montclair, is her department now. There's something to be said for chick flicks and microwave popcorn, especially when the weather is lousy and the little cottage seems as oddly deserted as the town itself. Last week, though, the pervasive cold front finally pushed on past the coast, taking with it endless drizzle and gloomy skies. The local action picked up drastically as hordes of summer people arrived, and it started to feel more like summer at last, even at the cottage, even without Mike. Summer without Mike. Unbelievable.